The Woman in White by Wilkie Collins. The story continued by Walter Hartwright. Part 1. My first impulse after reading Mrs. Catherick's extraordinary narrative was to destroy it. The hardened, shameless depravity of the whole composition from beginning to end, the atrocious perversity of mind which persistently associated me with a calamity for which I was in no sense answerable, and with a death which I had risked my life in trying to avert, so disgusted me that I was on the point of tearing the letter, when a consideration suggested itself which warned me to wait a little before I destroyed it. This consideration was entirely unconnected with Sir Percival. The information communicated to me, so far as it concerned him, did little more than confirm the conclusions at which I had already arrived. He had committed his offense, as I had supposed him to have committed it, and the absence of all reference, on Mrs. Catherick's part, to the duplicate register at Knowlesbury strengthened my previous conviction that the existence of the book and the risk of detection which it implied must have been necessarily unknown to Sir Percival. My interest in the question of the forgery was now at an end, and my only object in keeping the letter was to make it of some future service in clearing up the last mystery that still remained to baffle me, the parentage of Anne Catherick on the father's side. There were one or two sentences dropped in her mother's narrative which it might be useful to refer to again, when matters of more immediate importance allowed me leisure to search for the missing evidence. I did not despair of still finding that evidence, and I had lost none of my anxiety to discover it, for I had lost none of my interest in tracing the father of the poor creature who now lay at rest in Mrs. Fairley's grave. Accordingly, I sealed up the letter and put it away carefully in my pocketbook, to be referred to again when the time came. The next day was my last in Hampshire. When I had appeared again before the magistrate at Knowlesbury, and when I had attended at the adjourned inquest, I should be free to return to London by the afternoon or the evening train. My first errand in the morning was, as usual, to the post office. The letter from Marian was there, but I thought, when it was handed to me, that it felt unusually light. I anxiously opened the envelope. There was nothing inside but a small strip of paper folded in two. The few blotted, hurriedly written lines which were traced on it contained these words: "Come back as soon as you can. I have been obliged to move. Come to Gower's Walk, Fulham, No. 5. I will be on the lookout for you. Don't be alarmed about us. We are both safe and well. But come back, Marian." The news which those lines contained, news which I instantly associated with some attempted treachery on the part of Count Fosco, fairly overwhelmed me. I stood breathless with the paper crumbled up in my hand. What had happened? What subtle wickedness had the Count planned and executed in my absence? A night had passed since Marian's note was written. Hours must elapse still before I could get back to them. Some new disaster might have happened already, of which I was ignorant. And here, miles and miles away from them, here I must remain, held, doubly held, at the disposal of the law. I hardly know to what forgetfulness of my obligations anxiety and alarm might not have tempted me, but for the quieting influence of my faith in Marian. My absolute reliance on her was the one earthly consideration which helped me to restrain myself and give me courage to wait. The inquest was the first of the impediments in the way of my freedom of action. I attended it at the appointed time, the legal formalities requiring my presence in the room, but as it turned out, not calling on me to repeat my evidence. This useless delay was a hard trial, although I did my best to quiet my impatience by following the course of the proceedings as closely as I could. The London solicitor of the deceased, Mr. Merriman, was among the persons present, but he was quite unable to assist the objects of the inquiry. He could only say that he was inexpressibly shocked and astonished, and that he could throw no light whatever on the mysterious circumstances of the case. At intervals during the adjourned investigation, he suggested questions which the coroner put, but which led to no results. After a patient inquiry, which lasted nearly 3 hours and which exhausted every available source of information, the jury pronounced the customary verdict in cases of sudden death by accident. They added to the formal decision a statement that there had been no evidence to show how the keys had been extracted, how the fire had been caused, or what the purpose was for which the deceased had entered the vestry. This act closed the proceedings. The legal representative of the dead man was left to provide for the necessities of the interment, and the witnesses were free to retire. Resolved not to lose a minute in getting to Knowlesbury, I paid my bill at the hotel and hired a fly to take me to the town. A gentleman who heard me give the order and who saw that I was going alone informed me that he lived in the neighborhood of Knowlesbury and asked if I would have any objection to his getting home by sharing the fly with me. I accepted his proposal as a matter of course. Our conversation during the drive was naturally occupied by the one absorbing subject of local interest. My new acquaintance had some knowledge of the late Sir Percival's solicitor, and he and Mr. Merriman had been discussing the state of the deceased gentleman's affairs and the succession to the property. Sir Percival's embarrassments were so well known all over the country that his solicitor could only make a virtue of necessity and plainly acknowledge them. He had died without leaving a will, and he had no personal property to bequeath. Even if he had made one, the whole fortune which he had derived from his wife having been swallowed up by his creditors. The heir to the estate, Sir Percival having left no issue, was a son of Sir Felix Glyde's first cousin, an officer in command of an East Indiaman. He would find his unexpected inheritance sadly encumbered, but the property would recover with time, and if the captain was careful, he might be a rich man yet before he died. Absorbed as I was in the one idea of getting to London, this information, which events proved to be perfectly correct, had an interest of its own to attract my attention. I thought it justified me in keeping secret my discovery of Sir Percival's fraud. The heir, whose rights he had usurped, was the heir who would now have the estate. The income from it, for the last 23 years, which should property have been his, and which the dead man had squandered to the last farthing, was gone beyond recall. If I spoke, my speaking would confer advantage on no one. If I kept the secret, my silence concealed the character of the man who had cheated Laura into marrying him. For her sake, I wished to conceal it. For her sake still, I tell this story under feigned names. I parted with my chance companion at Knowlesbury and went at once to the town hall. As I had anticipated, no one was present to prosecute the case against me. The necessary formalities were observed, and I was discharged. On leaving the court, a letter from Mr. Dawson was put into my hand. It informed me that he was absent on professional duty, and it reiterated the offer I had already received from him of any assistance which I might require at his hands. I wrote back, warmly acknowledging my obligations to his kindness and apologizing for not expressing my thanks personally, in consequence of my immediate recall on pressing business to town. Half an hour later, I was speeding back to London by the express train. End of chapter. Read by Lorraine Montgomery for Lit2Go on the web at fcit.usf.edu.